Good afternoon and welcome to Memorial Medical Center Pathology Teleconference. Today's program is entitled Acute Leukemia. We will begin with the formal presentation given by our speaker, followed by a discussion period at the end of the program. Please remember to mute your speakerphone by pressing the mute button on your speakerphone. The speaker for today is Dr. Nagendra. Dr. Nagendra is the Medical Director of Microbiology and Hematology at Memorial Medical Center. He is also a member of Pathology Associates of Central Illinois and a professor at SIU School of Medicine Department of Pathology. At this time, I would like to turn the program over to Dr. Nagendra.
Good afternoon, and thanks for listening in on this teleconference today. I'm going to talk about the acute leukemia as we go through it, and if you have any questions, there'll be some time at the end that you can ask questions. So any of the live participants, you know, they're also feel free to ask any questions that come up at the end, and I'll be glad to answer. Okay, so we're going to go forward one slide, which is acute leukemia. We're going to go forward once again to the next slide, slide number three. Acute leukemia is a disorder of the neoplastic disorder of either lymphoid cells or myeloid cells or myeloid precursors. So it's divided into two different types, acute lymphoblastic leukemia and acute myeloblastic leukemia. And I'm going to be talking about each of these separately in this talk. So we'll go to slide number four, the acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And slide number five. Now, what is acute lymphoblastic leukemia? Well, it's a neoplastic proliferation of lymphoblasts. And these lymphoblasts are really immature lymphoid cells that have their origin in a progenitor cell. It means a cell that will, it's a very immature cell that can differentiate into mature cells. That's a progenitor cell. Most acute lymphoblastic leukemias occur in children, young children. 80% occur at the age of four, with the peak incidence of age four in young children. There's also kind of a bimodal distribution where you can also have an increased incidence later on in life. Most of the occurrence occurs in young children. And for some reason, we don't know why, but there's a higher incidence of ALL in countries like the United States and Europe, in Western Europe and even Australia compared to other nations in Asia and Africa. And we don't know really why, whether there's some sort of environmental occurrence there that is making it more likely. Let's go to the next slide, slide number six. So everybody wants to know why somebody gets ALL, and the biggest reason of why somebody might get ALL is the third choice, which is idiopathic. So even now, it's 2010, and we still don't know why somebody might have gotten it. And that's very difficult in this time period to know, because we try to have explanations for a lot of things. We don't have a good explanation. But there are studies that show that environmental factors like ionizing radiation, especially in utero. So, you know, people that were, last month we had this talk about radiation, and Chernobyl was brought up. The disaster occurred in 1986. So after the disaster, there were patients that, that developed, there was increased incidence of ALL, lymphoblastic leukemia, thyroid cancers, and all those things. So that might be due to the ionizing radiation. That's one of the things. And most people don't have any exposure to excessive amounts of ionizing radiation. Chromosomal instability syndromes, these are all rare syndromes that have increased risk of ALL. Down syndrome, ataxia telangiectasia, and Bloom syndrome. Those, the latter two diseases are these are instabilities of the chromosomes, and so the chromosomes, they break, and so then they can't repair themselves properly, And so then they get increased risks of these hematologic malignancies and idiopathic, as I just stated. Okay, we'll go to slide number 7. So how do patients present? Well, it's pretty abrupt or onset of symptoms. That's why we call it acute. And most of the symptoms are related to bone marrow depression. They may present with, so due to bone marrow depression, they may present with infection due to decreased neutrophil count, joint pain, and joint pain is due to excessive proliferation of these blasts. So they're expanding in a small space, and they can't, so it presses on the periosteum and presses on nerve fibers, and you get pain due to pressure. Bleeding, and that bleeding would be due to low platelets. And fatigue due to anemia. So go to the next slide, slide number 8. So this is a child that has acute lymphoblastic leukemia and looks overly pale and has this petechial-like rash on his chest, which is finding that you could see due to low platelets. Next slide, slide number 9. So peripheral blood findings may be normal initially, or they could have anemia, thrombocytopenia, low platelets, or leukopenia, normal leukocyte count, or leukocytosis. I'll give you an example of a case that happened a couple of years ago in this area, and this patient was a 22-year-old female that came in with kind of infections, headaches, and they did a CBC on the outside hospital, and it was relatively normal, but all the counts were normal. And then about a week or two later, they did a CBC again, and she wasn't getting better, and her platelet count had gone down a little bit, and it was trending downward. So with her symptoms of thrombocytopenia, but her hemoglobin was normal, they decided to do a bone marrow, and she had early acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Now, we went back and looked at some smears from when her counts were normal and looked, and I found some rare blasts. So I think that this is a disorder. When we say acute, it's not 1 or 2 days. I think it's like a couple of weeks. So it's kind of a subacute illness. It happens. It doesn't happen like one day you have it, one day you don't. That might happen, but you don't recognize it. It might take a little bit of time for you to recognize the disorder. So, but we have seen several cases that come in with normal counts, but then you look at the smear and they have abnormal cells. So it's very important as a medical technologist to look at those smears. You're in the front lines to look and triage the cases. Okay, next slide, slide number 10. The WHO classification. So in teaching, the hematopathology is science that has multiple classification systems. It's a little bit better than microbiology where we don't change the names as often as they do, but we had a French-American-British classification that first met in 1976 that discussed classification. Then the World Health Organization started classifying these, and they had more consensus conference, and in 2001 they put up a classification scheme, and this was revised again in 2008, but with some minor revisions. But what these classification schemes do or is incorporate, first they look at morphology, what you're looking in the microscope, and they incorporate cytogenetic information and flow cytometry. So initially in 1976, there was no flow cytometry. So everything was based upon looking in the microscope, and there were certain cytochemical tests that people used to do. Now that's kind of going away, and we're having more flow cytometry and cytogenetics. And cytogenetics is becoming very important, and I'll talk about that. Greater than 20% blasts are required to make a diagnosis of acute leukemia, including ALL. So the next slide, we're going to slide number 11. So this is a busy diagram describing the ontogeny of a lymphoid cell. So a lot of, many malignancies will kind of try to mimic how these cells are normally, how these cells normally mature. So first you have a lymphoid cell that is CD34 positive. So it's a very immature cell. It just has CD34 on it. So then it can go in two different ways. It can either become a B cell or it can become a T cell. And the B cell then acquires certain markers. And you can, I'm not going to go through the whole thing. See that it, one of the markers it does get is TDT, terminal deoxytransferase. And that's a very important marker of ALL. And so you keep going, and it adds certain markers. It adds CD19, then it adds CD10. Then it finally adds CD20 in the normal maturation sequence and cytoplasmic mu chain. Then the B cell matures enough that it loses TDT and loses and then it acquires surface immunoglobulin. So that's kind of more of a mature B cell that you see. And if it really gets mature and wants to secrete immunoglobulin, then it becomes a plasma cell. So most of the acute lymphoblastic leukemias B cell occur at this stage here, where they're TDT positive, CD10 positive, and CD19 positive. Those are called the precursor B acute lymphoblastic leukemias. So those are the most common. The T cell is also the precursor. There's also precursor T acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and that develops. If you look at the ontogeny here, you're having TDT expression with CD34, then going on it acquires CD7, CD2, CD5, and CD34, and as it goes, then at one point it has CD4 and CD8. So this is maturing normally in the thymus. These cells. And most of the precursor T acute lymphoblastic leukemias are in this stage here, where they have 4 and 8 and CDT and CD1A on it. And but at some point, then these T cells here, the CD4 and CD8 will then either commit and become a cytotoxic T cell, CD8 positive, or a helper-induced T cell, CD4 positive. And the CD8, CD4 positive cells, then they're going to be only a minority of them normally in the peripheral blood or bone marrow. But these are the cells that are TDT positive that can develop into precursor T ALL. So let's go to the next slide, slide number 12. So now we'll talk a little bit about precursor B acute lymphoblastic leukemia. It usually presents in children, young children, less than 5. They can present with a variety of symptoms. They can have normal counts, or they can have pancytopenia due to an extensive marrow involvement or a dry tap. When you have a patient, you, as medical technologists, you will often see patients that are pancytopenic. They have low counts. So always important when you have somebody with low counts, more than just anemia, but at least if you have anemia and thrombocytopenia, that's a clue. It's kind of at least a bicytopenia to start looking for unusual cells or abnormal cells. And they could be really rare. And you may not even find the cells in the peripheral blood. You might just find them in the bone marrow. Acute lymphoblastic leukemia can occasionally present with lymph node involvement, but no marrow involvement. And that's called acute lymphoblastic lymphoma. That occasionally occurs. But the diseases are synonymous to acute lymphoblastic lymphoma / acute lymphoblastic leukemia. You can have it in both sites usually. So precursor B's ALLs are 85% of all ALLs, and the rest 15% are T cells. Slide number 13, we can see these lymphoid blasts. And the lymphoid blasts generally... the most common type, they don't have very much cytoplasm. They kind of look like you've taken smudged the chromatin, and there's just a little hint of cytoplasm in some of these cells. Next slide, slide 14. but some acute lymphoblastic leukemias can have more cytoplasm. In the old days, we used to call the slide number 13 one L1 morphology, and the slide 14, the one we're looking at now, looking for L2 morphology. But now, because of flow and cytogenetics and things, we've kind of moved away from that. They used to classify prognosis based upon morphology. But now we're a little bit more sophisticated. We can do cytogenetics and flow cytometry to determine what these are. Slide number 15, next slide. The flow cytometry is very important in differentiating acute leukemias and determining whether they're lymphoblastic or myeloid. And the common precursor B-ALL is positive for CD19, CD10, and TDT, and negative for immunoglobulin, surface or cytoplasmic immunoglobulin. So that's a pretty common immunophenotype you'll see. All ALLs now we send out for cytogenetics. And we can do either FISH studies, which we're looking at interphase cells, cells that are not dividing, so you can look at a lot of cells, or you can look at metaphase, conventional cytogenetics. In conventional cytogenetics, you look at metaphase cells, cells that are dividing. And you usually they look at about 20 cells, so, but with FISH, you look at 200 cells. FISH is for specific abnormalities, and cytogenetics can look at a lot of different abnormalities. So here's some translocations, 411, which is a poor prognosis. 922, a poor prognosis. That's the Philadelphia chromosome. And also we look at the number of chromosomes. Hypodiploidy means, so normally we should have 46 XX or XY. So if we have hypodiploidy, we have less than 46. So we have 44 chromosomes or less is hypodiploidy. Or hyperdiploidy greater than 50 chromosomes, that's supposed to be a favorable problem. So we can look at all these things, and the hematologist, oncologist can chart all these things and determine where prognostic information. Let's go to slide 16. So now that we have some idea of precursor B-ALL, precursor T-ALL, we see a case one every couple years at this institution. But this is a disorder that presents usually in adolescence, and for some reason males are affected a little bit more than females. And they often present with a mediastinal mass, which could cause like obstruction, cough, persistent cough, so they can have that kind of symptoms. Really high white count, greater than 100,000. So I call that hyperleukocytosis. And they could even have mental status changes, things due to cerebrospinal CNS involvement, central nervous system involvement. And this disorder is rapidly progressive. Let's go to slide number 17. And here we have a patient with precursor T-ALL. And you couldn't necessarily tell these are T-cells, except unless you did flow. But these are immature cells that have fine chromatin. In the background, then you can see the red cells. And quite a few smudge cells, too, because these cells are sort of delicate. Slide 18. Here's another slide that shows these cells, fine chromatin cells. They can have light to moderate cytoplasm. Next slide, slide 19. So flow cytometry is very important in determining what this is, and these cells are usually positive for CD1, CD2, CD3, and they're dual positive for CD4 and CD8, and they're positive for the marker TDT. Very important in flow cytometry land that you don't confuse these for thymocytes. So let's say you had a mediastinal mass, and in the mediastinum, you often have thymus there, especially in adolescence, you know, you can find fragments of thymus. So you go in and you say they ask for flow on this, and the flow cytometry lab reports that there's these cells. And so it's important that, you know, we look at the whole setting and determine these are not thymocytes, because that could fool you, and then you could call something precursor T-ALL when they're really thymocytes. So that's a pitfall that we pathologists have to worry about. So cytogenetics, there's no particular abnormality, but there are various abnormalities that you can see precursor T-ALL. Slide number 20, therapies for ALL, usually multi-agent chemotherapy is used. prednisone, vincristine, methotrexate, cyclophosphamide, daunorubicin. So some of these, prednisone is a corticosteroid, vincristine is a vinca alkaloid, it kind of inhibits the microtubules. Methotrexate is an anti-metabolite. Cyclophosphamide and daunorubicin are cytotoxic agents that are alkylating agents. L-asparaginase is also an agent that's used that is more specific in the chemical pathways. So once they're treated with these drugs, then their counts will go low. And sometimes you can't, their counts may not recover, and they're even more set for infection. So some hemonc people will give them GCSF, granulocyte colony-stimulating factor, to increase their counts. And the other option that's done, and it's very important, is try to get these patients into remission and then do bone marrow transplant. Especially if a patient is less than 60 years old, bone marrow transplant is a very important therapy. So what they'll do is they'll ablate them, before ablating the marrow again with really high dose of chemotherapy, they'll collect stem cells. They can do that by peripheral blood, peripheral stem cells. You can get a matched donor, like a sibling, or an unrelated donor. That's called a matched unrelated donor, a MUD transplant. And you worry about graft versus host disease, those kind of rejection, where you can get rejection of the marrow by yourself, by the host. Those are some of the complications. But if it will engraft, and that's the best chance for permanent cure of disease. So they do bone marrow transplant on a lot of patients, usually on the outside. The closest center to Springfield, Central Illinois area is St. Louis. We'll go to the next slide, slide number 21. So before we had cytogenetics, we used to look at other prognostic findings. So good prognosis, young age, less than 10, normal white count, precursor, the normal phenotype, CD10 positive, 19 positive, CD positive precursor B cells. Often we do a bone marrow at day 14, and if after chemotherapy, and at day 14, if they don't have very many cells or malignant cells or the disease-free, that's a good prognosis. And as I said, hyperdiploidy. But everything now, I think, in the future for ALL is going to look at complex chromosomal, what chromosomal abnormalities there were. That's going to be the key. Unfortunately, in the last 20, 30 years, we haven't come very far in treatment of ALL. A lot of people will, the majority will come into remission if they have favorable cytogenetics, but we don't have, I think our classifications of ALL are a little bit ahead of the therapy itself. So let's go to slide number 22 and 23, which we're going to talk about the acute myeloblastic leukemias. And that's a neoplastic proliferation of hematopoietic precursor cells. And these cells are non-lymphocytes, so they're anything that are not lymphoid. So myeloblasts, promyeloblasts, so they could be from other cell lines like erythroid cell line, monocytic cell line, megakaryocytic cell line. Slide number 24, you might have seen the schematic diagram, which kind of demonstrates myelopoiesis. And I think that to understand acute myelogenous leukemia, it's good to look at this diagram because you have the myeloid stem cell here, and that can differentiate several different ways. It can differentiate into the neutrophil through the blast, promyelocyte, myelocyte, metamyelocyte band, and neutrophil. It go through eosinophils, that same stage, basophils, that way, and it could go, the myeloid stem cell could become a red cell through pronormal blast, basophilic normal blast, etc. It can become a megakaryocyte, or it can become a monocyte through this stage. So many of these acute myelogenous leukemia will try to recapitulate these pathways. So I want to talk about the most common type of acute myelogenous leukemias in the remainder of the talk. Slide 25. In contrast to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, 80% of acute myelogenous leukemias occurred in adults, and only 20% occurred in children. So the opposite is true for ALL. Wonder why when you think about any malignancy, most people think that it's just due to cells that are just not, they're just keep on dividing. But there's another way to look at this, and in acute myelogenous leukemia and acute lymphoblastic leukemia, it's not due to excessive proliferation of these cells, but they're not maturing. So at some point in their maturation sequence, at the myelocyte stage, they need to stop, they need to start maturing beyond that stage, but this one, they just stay at that one stage and don't go beyond that. Let's go to the slide number 26. Risk factors for AML include similar type of congenital diseases, trisomy 21 Down syndrome, Fanconi's anemia, neurofibromatosis are some disorders that can have increased risk. Environmental exposures, benzene, ionizing radiation, alkylating agents. So unfortunately, patients that have been treated for other solid tumors can have an increased risk of developing AML in the future. So these are like therapy-induced AML. People that have been treated, for example, I knew there was a patient that had osteosarcoma, bone cancer, when they were young, and then they were treated with all these agents. And then, 15, 20 years later, then they developed AML, through myelogenous leukemia syndrome. Breast cancers, too, treating with all this these cytotoxic agents, they can develop AML in the future. So that's one of the unfortunate side effects of these therapies. But the number one, etiology for AML is idiopathic. We don't know. Clinical presentation are similar to ALL. It's due to the replacement of the marrow by blast. And that will cause fatigue, infection, bleeding, bone pain. And sometimes these blasts can go to other sites, like they can go into the gums, spleen, and they can cause, gum hyperplasia, or gingival hyperplasia. Let's go to slide number 28. So WHO classification, the 2001 classification, and the new revised 2008 classification relies on morphology, cytochemistry, flow cytometry, cytogenetics, and molecular studies. So we look at all those things, put them together, and make a diagnosis. And prior to 2001, we were requiring 30% blast to call a diagnosis of acute leukemia. But in 2001, we went down to 20% because we think that we should treat these patients even between 20 and 30% of the AML. Slide number 29. Before the onset of flow cytometry, we used to try to differentiate whether we could tell between myeloid blasts and lymphoid blasts. And they're really difficult definitively tell, but you can guess that sometimes it can be difficult. But usually myeloid blasts are usually larger and they exhibit more cytoplasm than lymphoid blasts. Myeloid blasts can have aura, but lymphoid blasts never have aura. So that's one of the things. Auras are fusion of these primary granules, which we'll look at. Myeloblasts are usually myeloperoxidase positive, but not all are. And if you do flow cytometry, they're positive for myeloid antigens. CD13, CD33, and CD15 are examples. Okay. We're going to go to slide number 30. And before we had flow cytometry, one of the quick things we could do is a myeloperoxidase. Because if we knew that these blasts are myeloperoxidase positive, then we could say that these are myeloid blasts. And this stain is pretty rapid. You could do it in a few minutes. So this is an example of a positive myeloperoxidase stain. And the ones that are heavily granulated are the mature neutrophils, and the ones that are mildly granulated are the blasts. Let's go to slide 31. One of the important take-home points is about AURAs. AURAs are fusion of primary granules creating this azure-philic rod, They're found in many AMLs, not all AMLs, though, but never in ALL. So that's one of the things that if you see an RROD, you know it's not ALL. Slide 32, please. And this is an example of a patient with myeloid blast and RROD. Let's see the RROD here. Two of them, three of them. Slide 33. This is a more subtle example of RRODs. And these are blasts here. The blasts have really fine chromatin, multiple small nucleoli. And then when you start seeing these kind of cells, you're always going to look for RRODs. And you can see a small RROD in one of these cells sort of in the center here. Slide 34. Flow cytometry can be done. And what we do is we gate upon cells based upon their brightness. And the really bright cells that are CD45 positive, CD45 is a leukocyte common antigen, are going to be the lymphocytes. And the CD45 dim cells are the cells that are usually in the blast case. So the flow cytometry technologists will gate along these cells. And then they can look at positivity of these cells to different markers. In this example, they're positive for CD13, which is a myeloid marker, and CD34. So we know that based upon these markers, we know that these are expressing myeloid markers and immature progenitor markers. CD34 is hematopoietic progenitor marker. It's an immature marker. So I think that the medical technology should have a basic understanding of the subclassification of acute myelogenous leukemia. Not that you may make that diagnosis, but I think that it'll make your lives more interesting too to know that. So then when you see these patients coming through, you'll know what kind of leukemia they have. And it may make it easier for you to count these cells too. So we'll go to slide 36 now. And I'm going to quickly go through these. But one of the first acute leukemias we want to talk about is acute myeloblastic leukemia minimally differentiated. And this was called the AML M0s in the old classification scheme. And these are myeloid leukemias that you can't tell that they're myeloid unless you do flow. And they express myeloid antigens like CD13 and CD33. And they're usually myeloperoxidase negative. So go to slide 37. And these cells, they don't have RROD. If they had RROD, you'd know they're myeloid. And if you did a cytochemical stain, you can't tell. And these leukemias usually they don't do as well as some other acute myelogenous leukemias. Okay, slide 38. The next type is acute myeloblastic leukemia without maturation. And this leukemia is about 10 to 20% of AML cases. And we classify this by looking at the percentage of non-erythroid cells that are myeloblasts. So if they're greater than 90%, we can put them in that category. That means that in this leukemia, there's not much maturation. There's not much maturing granulocytes. If you did a cytochemical stain or flow cytometry, you would note that these are myeloperoxidase positive, and they're positive by flow for myeloid markers. So patient with M1. Pretty poorly differentiated blasts here. You don't see any RRODs necessarily. You may find chromatin scan basophilic cytoplasm. This is a Sudan blast stain that some laboratories used to do in the past. We're not doing it as much, but they're not only positive for myeloperoxidase, but there's a stain called Sudan blast B. And you can do it. This is in Japan. Slide number 41, acute myeloblastic leukemia with maturation is a pretty common subtype of AML, and it's about 30 to 45% of AML cases. And so in this kind of leukemia, there is some maturation. There's some granulocytic maturation. So you might only have 20% blast, and you'll have the rest of the cells being mature granulocytes, for example. There's a certain percentage you can read there. The monocytic precursors are less than 20%. Most blasts are myeloperoxidase positive, and you might see RRODs, multiple of them. You might even see multiple RRODs. And it's often associated with a cytogenic amyloid 821 translocation. And, it's, and that 821 translocation is associated with a favorable prognosis. Slide 42, this is a patient with AML, M2, or with maturation. And you see these blasts here, but in the background, you do see some maturing granulocytes as well. And in the old days, we used to do these stains. So they're mild peroxidase positive, but now we have flow cytometry. So the next type of acute myelogenous leukemia is very important. It's the acute promyelocytic leukemia. And this is very important to recognize for the reasons I'll state shortly. It occurs in about 10 to 15% of AML cases. And most cells are abnormal promyelocytes, greater than 50%. Patients often present with leukopenia, and they are in DIC, disseminated intravascular coagulation. If you look at a peripheral blood smear of these patients, they are often in pancytopenia. But if you did a bone marrow on these patients, you would see abnormal promyelocytes. And these, and if you did cytogenetics, they would show this translocation 15-17. And breakpoints of this translocation are the promyelocytic leukemia gene and the retinoic acid receptor alpha gene. And so what happens is because of this translocation, the gene product produces an abnormal retinoic acid receptor, and that blocks myelodifferentiation. So they're stuck at being promyelocytes. They can't differentiate. So if you, there's a drug that you can use called all-trans-retinoic acid, ATRA. Use this drug, and it differentiates, makes these promyelocytes differentiate into neutrophils. And so actually, that's good, because if you have these promyelocytes just staying there, they not only will depress the counts, they will also, they can degranulate and activate the coagulation cascade and cause bleeding and thrombosis in the patient's body. Go to slide 46, and this is an example of a patient with APL. These are the really hypogranular abnormal promyelocytes here. Okay, let's go to slide number 47. And sometimes you can see multiple owl rods in these patients. Okay, let's go to 48. This is the important translocation that you can see, 15-17 translocation. So before we go on to acute myelomonocytic leukemia, I want to say that for this reason, it's really important to try to find these patients because unfortunately, when I was in training, I saw a patient or heard of a patient that they didn't recognize this when he was living, and he had a brain hemorrhage. He died, and then they did, later on, they brought him in, and they found out that he had this, and he had it because these promyelocytes. So it's really important to recognize this disorder. Okay, we'll go to slide number 49, acute myelomonocytic leukemia, and that's 15 to 20% of AML. And this, you often see patients that are presented with really high white counts, enlarged liver and spleen, and tissue infiltrate. So this disease likes to go into other tissues, like gums, brain, I mean, anywhere it can go. Myoblasts and monoblasts are more than 20% of the non-erythroid cells. So there's a lot of, there's some monocytic differentiation here, but there's also granulocytic differentiation too. Let's go to slide 50. And here, sometimes it can be very hard to tell which are, whether there's monocytic differentiation here. So we can do flow cytometry, and that might give us a clue that there's some monocytic differentiation. And there's other stains we can do, too. I mean, this is morphology, and you can see these are pretty nondescript blasts. Fine chromatin, they're pretty monomorphic. Slide 51, we used to do a nonspecific esterase stain, and that will show, this brown staining will show that these are monocytic cells. And we still often do these stains in conjunction with flow cytometry to tell, because the flow cytometry, you can't, with flow cytometry, you can't actually see the cells that are abnormal. You just look at a diagram of the whole thing. With cytochemistry, you can still see what cells are abnormal. and what they're stating with. Let's go to slide 52. Leukemias with monocytic differentiation, that occurs 10 to 12% of cases. So these are the acute monoblastic and acute monocytic leukemias. And they can present with, also present with DIC, disseminated vascular coagulation, and these leukemias can occur on the outside. They can go outside the marrow. They can go to other sites. We had one patient in 2000, several years ago, that presented with just lung involvement, and it was a very difficult diagnosis, and they also had it in their bone marrow. So, and some of these tumors just have this tropism towards certain organs. We've had other cases that just have tropism to skin, and they don't go anywhere else. Those are called extramedullary myeloid tumors. So let's go to slide 53. So acute leukemias with monocytic differentiation are divided into acute monoblastic leukemia and acute monocytic leukemia. And acute monoblastic leukemia are just immature monoblasts. Monocytic leukemias are ones that have monoblasts but also have some cells that are not quite monocytes, but they're immature monocytes, and they're known as promonocytes. Let's go to slide 54. And these are just nondescript monoblasts here. You can't necessarily tell that these are monoblasts unless you do flow cytometry or cytochemistry. Slide 55 shows that these cells were stained with nonspecific esterase stain, and they are positive, so you know that they're of monocytic derivation. So another subtype that's sort of rare is acute erythroid leukemia. And we've seen a couple of cases in the last 5-6 years, 3 to 5% of AML cases. And this usually occurs in the elderly, and they present with really low counts, pancytopenia. If you did a marrow count on them, they are greater than 50% of nucleated bone marrow cells are erythroid precursors, so there are lots of erythroid precursors. But they're also increased blasts. In the background, there's what we call looks like myelodysplasia. There's a lot of dyspoiesis. I'll show you that in the next slide, 57 here. First, you can see these are blasts in the center. And in the side here, you have these abnormal erythroid precursors. This one below the blast has this really open chromatin, and it looks kind of megaloblastic or megaloblastoid. Slide 58 shows the other dyspoiesis that you can see around it. You can see that there's a budding erythroid precursors here, and in the center there are all these blasts. And in the old days, we didn't do flow cytometry, and so we wouldn't know there were erythroid derivation. The other thing you could do is a PAS stain. If you do a PAS stain, you see these rings around these erythroid precursors. So it's nice for pictures to see that, but we don't generally do that anymore. Slide 60, we're coming to the end of this subclassification, acute megakaryocytic leukemia, and I've seen a few cases. And remember I stated that most acute leukemia, myeloid leukemias occur in adults, but acute megakaryocytic leukemia disproportionately occurs in children, and up to 10% of AMLs in children, and especially in patients with Down syndrome. Peripheral blood often contains megakaryocyte fragments or micromegakaryocytes, and abnormal platelets. And if you did a bone marrow, they're greater than 20% blast in the bone marrow. We can do flow cytometry, and they express megakaryocytic antigens, such as CD61 and CD41. Let's go to slide 61, and this is a megakaryoblast here, and this looks like a big megakaryocyte, and then they have these pseudopodia here, and they are actually platelets. So somebody with acute megakaryocytic leukemia could potentially, if it's well-differentiated, present with a thrombocytosis. Slide 62 shows these megakaryoblasts that are not as well-differentiated, but they're very large cells with fine chromatin, moderate cytoplasm, some hint of pseudopodia. Okay, now that we looked at the subtypes of AML, I just want to go over briefly the cytogenetics. The 15-17 translocation is a favorable prognosis. That's associated with acute promyelocytic leukemia. The 821 translocation is also a favorable prognosis, and that's associated with acute myelocytic leukemia with maturation. The 922 translocation can occur in any acute leukemia or chronic leukemia, chronic myelogenous leukemia typically, that's a Philadelphia chromosome, can occur in ALLs and can also occur in AMLs, and that's usually a poor prognostic indicator. And there's also this inversion 16 where you get a lot of eosinophils, and that's a favorable prognosis. So again, prognostic factors for AML, cytogenetics, the morphology, whether or not they had myelodysplastic syndrome in the past. If this is coming from myelodysplastic syndrome, usually they have multiple chromosomal abnormalities, and the prognosis is not as good. The initial response to chemotherapy is important because that means our therapies are working. If they're working, then you know, they have a better chance. White cell count greater than 100,000, that's not good. If you have a high burden of malignancy, then it's harder to eradicate. Age and comorbid conditions. If you have other diseases, it's harder to treat. Now, I find it really amazing that we can get cures for some of these diseases because we're dealing with billions and billions of abnormal cells, and we're trying to reduce it with chemotherapy. And but what happens is that you're reducing 99.9%, but then there's still a small number of cells, and you're that's why you're hitting it with chemotherapy so many times to try to get rid of those cells. And we have cures. We still are able to have cures, even though there's a small population of cells that potentially could not be eradicated. But that's one of the reasons why some of these recurrent relapses we have is that, you know, they look like they're fine for years and then it comes back is because there's a small population of cells that are in check and suddenly they start coming through. So treatment, just like ALL, you have induction chemotherapy first, where you treat the patients really hard with chemo and try to get them into remission. And once you get them into remission, then you do a maintenance therapy. And that can last for a long time. So you're trying to get the 0.001% of cells with the post-remission maintenance therapy. And with the induction therapy, you're trying to get the 99% of cells. And again, bone marrow transplantation is used in patients less than 60. In patients between 60 and 70, they sometimes use what's called non-myeloablative therapy, where they might not use very as a harsh a chemotherapeutic regimen in bone marrow transplant. So you can, but in any of these, you can have sibling HLA matched and matched unrelated donor transplants. The unrelated donor transplants are higher risk for rejection, graft versus host disease, and you wouldn't want to use autologous bone marrow transplant. Because you're thinking that you created these bad cells from your cells, so if you're going to give them back, then you might be giving back the disease again. Okay, so I didn't tell you this in the beginning, but we're going to have a few case studies, and hopefully you can answer some of those some questions. So to see whether whether you can remember some of the stuff that I presented. Slide 67, a 45-year-old male presents with malaise and gingival bleeding. And the CBC shows anemia, hemoglobin 8.7, white cell count 122,000, so that's really high, isn't it? And a platelet count of 54,000, so that's low. Okay, so we'll go to 68. And this is the slide. Look at it closely. What you see here, and you can come back to the slide, give it you another 5 seconds, and now we're going to go to slide 69. So I'm not asking what it is because that's too easy, so we're going to ask you something else. So which of the following is true? So first we need to know what these cells are, so we need to go back to slide 68. And anybody in the audience, can you tell me what? It's an hour rod. So there are hour rods here. So based upon that, we can go back to the choices. 69, 569.
All of the above.
Okay, we have an answer already. Okay, So let's look. Very quick. Very good. Okay, so the patient's blast will be positive for myeloperoxidase. So that would be true, because if they have our rods, they would have myeloperoxidase. So that's true. The patient's blasts are likely CD33 positive. And CD33 is a myeloid antigen. So that's true. So if you have our rods, they would be positive for CD33. So that's true. The patient's blasts are likely CD34 positive. And so it's a blast. And most blasts are CD34 positive. And I noticed I said are likely, because sometimes they're not all. So the answer is all of the above. So good job. We're going to go to slide number 70 now. 16-year-old female complains of diffuse arthralgia, so joint pain, nausea, and vomiting. And the CBC shows a hemoglobin of 7.4, so that's low, a white cell count of 500, so that's really low, and a platelet count of 114,000. So that's thrombocytopenia, myelodysplastic. So let's go to slide 71. And we have these cells here. Look at those closely. So look for anything in the cytoplasm. Okay, so we'll go to slide 72. A 300-cell differential reveals 97% blast without our rods. And normal hematopoiesis is decreased. So we did flow, and it showed the blast to be positive for CD19, CD10, and TDT. So they're positive for those markers and negative for CD13 and CD33. So, and the cytogenetics were sent out, and they revealed translocation 411. So we're getting... I think we have some people in the room here that know the answer, but they have to see the question first. So that's slide 73. Okay, well, we have another thing here that shows some of these blasts on this slide here that are, they don't have very much cytoplasm, no our rods. So which of the following is true? The patient has acute myeloblastic leukemia, poor prognosis. So is that true?
No.
Why not? It's not true because these blasts by flow are CD19 positive and 1019. So that they couldn't be myeloblastic. Second B, the patient has acute myeloblastic leukemia, good prognosis. That doesn't make sense. We can eliminate in B. C, the patient has acute lymphoblastic leukemia, good prognosis. No, because so it looks like by the flow they have 1019, so it's the ALL. But 411 is actually a poor prognosis. And we see some of these patients coming in. You hope we'll never see these kind of patients because they don't do well with even chemotherapy. So the answer is D, the patient has acute lymphoblastic leukemia, poor prognosis. Okay, slide 75. 31-year-old male presents with extreme fatigue. CBC shows marked leukopenia. So look, actually, there's a pancytopenia here. Hemoglobin 5.8. White cell count 400, platelet count 11,000. So as a technologist, this is a red flag. Before you even show it to pathologists, everything, this is where you can look and you can find cells, and you may be able to find abnormal cells here. So it's a big clue that there's something wrong, because a 31-year-old should not have that count anytime. Slide 76 shows these cells here. And look at these cells closely. I'm not going to describe them yet here. That's slide 77. Slide 78, which of the following is true? The patient's prothrombin time. So I'm going to get COAG into here too, you see. I'm not going to just forget about just hematology. So the patient's prothrombin time will be elevated. B, the patient should be initially treated with all transretinoic acid. C, the karyotype of the cell is 46XYT922. So what do you think about A? True or false? It's true, because this is actually acute promyelocytic leukemia, and they often present with DIC, and they're PT and PTT will be elevated. B, the patient should be initially treated with L-trans retinoic acid. That's true because APL, acute promyelocytic leukemia, that's what they usually treat with. They also treat it with regular chemotherapy, but that's one thing. The karyotype of these cells is 46XYT922. Now, that's false because T922 is CML, or it's a Philadelphia chromosome. So that's not an APL. APL is 1517. So the answer is D, A and B. Okay, we have the last question. 22-year-old male presents with leukocytosis. Peripheral smear shows reveals intermediate to large size blasts with fine chromatin and irregularly shaped nuclei. No AURAs are identified. Flow cytometric analysis shows a population of blasts that are positive for CD2, CD3, CD4, CD8, and CDT. So which of the following is true? So what is this disorder?
Acute T-cell.
Yeah, so it's precursor T, acute lymphoblastic leukemia. So this disorder is most common in patients less than 10. Is that true? That's false, because it occurs mostly in adolescents. Patients may present with concomitant lymphadenopathy, enlarged lymph nodes, and mediastinal mass. That would be true. Patients seldom have CNS involvement. So that's not true. They often have CNS involvement. T922 is often seen in this disorder. That's false. So B is true. You can have a mediastinal mass with this, and that's the only one that's true. Seldom. So they usually have CNS. Okay, so this has been about an hour talk on acute leukemias. So hopefully you're still with us, and would like to entertain any questions you'd have, just anything in general about what you might see for blasts. Anything I could help, I'd be glad to.
I do have one question, Dr. Nagendra. Can you tell me just a general timeline from the time we would get a patient specimen into our laboratory and hematology recognizes that it could possibly be a leukemia? From the time we get it, say it's an acute lymphoblastic leukemia, from the time we can to diagnosis, like how long it takes to get a flow,
mm-hmm.
flow cytometry done to it.
So let's say a patient came in at 7 a.m. Let's say it's during the daytime, which usually doesn't happen. Usually it's in the evening. But daytime, let's say they come in at 7 a.m. and then they blood drawn and everything. It's run around 9 o'clock or so. Then the instrument would flag everything, too. It would make a smear. And then technologists would look at a smear and determine that this is not normal. Would often show it to the pathologist. And at that point, then... usually these happen on a Friday, so what we do is that we want to at least get some information out of the clinician, so we could call them, say, we think this is acute leukemia, we could order flow. If we did that, then if by 9 or 10, by as early as noon, we might have some answers of what this is. So it can be rapid, especially if you have enough cells.
Great. So would you need to send it off for cytogenetics before treatment started?
Right. Usually they want to, especially if they want to know whether it's 15-17 translocation, they might wait, especially if we think the morphology looks like an acute promyelocytic leukemia. We can do cytogenetics. Cytogenetics they can do in a couple of days, but they can do FISH testing stat. So they can do that within 24 hours of receipt.
And the stability of the specimen, we need to have a specimen within 48 hours of collection?
For what? For
to have flow cytometry.
Flow cytometry, for a leukemic patient, you want to try to do it as soon as possible because some of those cells will degenerate. With lymphocytes, they can stay up to 72 hours sometimes. But, we prefer the sooner the better.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much, Dr. Nagendra. Really appreciate all of your presentation and also the comment that you made about medical laboratory scientists really being frontline in identifying these abnormalities.
That's extremely important because if you don't see the abnormality, then we don't see the abnormality. And so I think that's why you're key in making, you know, in establishing and in diagnosing these patients because you see this. So I think that's why it's really important for you. You may not be involved in the bone marrow after that and looking at it, but I think that since you've taken such an important role in patient care and flow cytometry and in the hematology lab, I think it's important for you to understand the whole process, and then you can understand how these patients did and their prognosis and gives you some sort of fulfillment sometimes.
Well, this concludes our program for today. Each site may document 1 hour of continuing education for those that were in attendance, or you may go to the website at a later time and listen. All PowerPoint and audio files of the 2010 Pathology Audio Conference presentations are available on the PACI website under Education Materials. Go to www.pacipath.com. Before reviewing the files, it's best to maybe to save it onto a flash drive or to your computer. And then an audio file will be attached on the education website for this conference within the next week. The next Memorial Pathology Teleconference is scheduled for August the 19th. A pathology audio conference will not be presented in July. The presenter will be Dr. John Murphy, and the topic of the presentation is to be announced. So thank you very much, and enjoy your summer.